Yeah, I wish I could say I'd recorded in like number two studio, which was the Beatles, but I did get to go in there actually with one of the EMI engineers because our producer went down with us, and I met him there, and we did some stuff down there, and then I got the tour of, and I stood in studio two, which, and I walked up those steps where George Martin used to sit, which is like, that was such a weird moment.
Day podcast radio show with Bruce Hilliard, today and every day, reaching out for innovative ideas in every way. Today's show is brought to you by Your Future. It comes with a lifetime guarantee.
Welcome back to the Better Each Day podcast radio show. And as always, it's great to have you. Today's guest is songwriter and recording artist Neil Fitzsimon of Fitzsimon and Brogan. Brogan is B. Brogan, that's her in the background singing. They are an item, and they are a songwriting duo. You'll hear Neil speak of Trudy. Well, that's B. Trudy is her birth name. Well, Neil will explain that in the episode. Fitzsimon and Brogan. All right, are you much of a techie?
No, not in a way. I mean, even when it comes to the recording, Trudy does all the nickname. That's her nickname. Her real name's Trudy. She does all the engineering of the stuff, and I just do the guitars. And everything. Yeah, I'm happy doing that.
Well, the English language, even though you guys invented it, I think you messed it all up because.
It's so difficult.
They speak a different version of it. I don't know.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. And the trouble with the English people is that when we go abroad, most of us think that everyone should speak English. And like when you get people from Europe coming to the UK, they can all speak, the majority can speak really good English. And when we go there, we don't even bother.
I interviewed an
imperialist type attitude, I think.
That's it. Okay. I was wondering. I've always been looking for the definition. There seems to be like a love affair between England and America. And a lot of it's come through music, which I think is really cool. Yeah.
Oh, it's great. Yeah.
I interviewed a band called Stilia. The interview ended up being the guitar player doing different versions of English accents. And I was puzzled because, Yorkshire has one, Liverpool has one. And to me, it's such a small country. How could it possibly have different accents? I mean, United States has like Southern, where if you go to Louisiana, I can barely understand what they're saying. But that's ways away.
I come from London, and there's a difference in accents between North and South London.
See, that wouldn't make any sense. You like cross the street and then all of a sudden it's different.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. It's mad, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess so. But it's interesting. So I asked him to do an American accent and he did something from a movie, but in mimicking the character in the movie Holes, I believe it was, it just sounded, he nailed it. It just sounded like somebody with about a fourth grade education talking or something. So that's what it sounds like.
Yeah. I remember because when we first got a deal, we actually did some interviews and live sessions on radio, like national radio as well. And it was terrifying. I mean, when we had to play live for the first time, it was we were a little bit reticent. And that's why I'm doing the interview, because B is not that great at doing interviews. She finds it hard to talk, where in the past I've always been like, when it was the band Pretty Blue Gun, I was their spokesman. And I guess I'm sort of like the spokesman for both of us now as well.
Yeah, some people shy away from it, and I'm a pretty nice guy. I'm not going to ask, if you do anything weird in the shower or anything like that,
Funny you should mention that.
Yeah, okay. That'll be the first topic. So Trudy is her birth name, and she goes by B?
Yeah, B, yeah. That's what her mum called her, and it just, stuck, and that's what we all call her. And we've been going out for quite a while now. But we actually met when she answered an ad for an audition for Girl Singers when we were like forming the band. And she sent me some of her stuff and everything. And I thought it was really good. I loved her voice. And I phoned her, never having spoken to her before, and said, I think your voice is good. Come along for this audition. She said, oh, actually, I would like my stuff back because I'm too nervous. Oh. And I actually said, oh, don't be so bloody ridiculous. I said, and that was the first words I ever said to her. That, so she's always remembered that. And then I actually managed to coerce her into coming around to my house first so I could teach her the track that we would be using in the audition. And there was about another 15 girls turning up. And she came for that, and she turned up for the audition, and she was, you know, she was easily the best that we saw. But it just shows you that people, you know, a lot of people, when they've got a talent like that, that they're not the ones that push themselves to the front.
I think, maybe nobody likes their own voice, or nobody likes their own photo. I don't know.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And all this, you're thinking you're great. Yeah, show up and do it.
Yeah, and she was really good. And then she said to me, I'll come along as long as we don't ever have to do any gigs. Because at the time, we were just like a songwriting partnership, me and this keyboard player. And I said, no, we won't have to do any gigs. And then within about a few months, we got offered a load of gigs. And I had to break the news to her that she would actually be doing, because she'd never played live in front of people before. And I think our first gig was in front of about 600 people, which is quite a big step, you know, for someone who's never been on stage before.
Yeah. It kind of doesn't make any difference. I think a living room's hard to play because everybody's, like, you know, intimately close in. I think if you're on a stage, it might be a little bit easier.
When we toured with Pretty Blue Gum, we toured with people from that film, The Commitments, which I think, I don't know if you had that. It's quite a big film about an Irish, like, soul band. I think it won an Oscar. And we went on tour with them. And to be quite honest, you know, some nights there were a couple of thousand there, and it didn't make any difference. As you said, when we played, like, different pubs and clubs in London, when there was about 10 or 15 people, that was more difficult, I would say.
Isn't that strange? It's psychological. I'm afraid of garter snakes, and they're harmless.
Yeah.
What's the deal? Yeah. And, yeah, you might as well be playing for 50,000 people.
Yeah.
Big Blue World. That's new. Yeah. Everything's new to me. I'm surprised I haven't heard of you guys. It just blows me away.
Well, we ran into trouble with our record company. That we signed to an indie label who then quickly got some licensing deals through Sony, and they started spending money like it was going out of fashion. You know, I mean, we did some of that our stuff down at Abbey Road and various other big-name studios, but by the time it came to our album being released, they'd run out of money, to be quite honest, and so there was no promotion behind it, and it just disappeared. And then we had to go through a legal thing with them. We sued them for restraint of trade, but it took 16 months to get out of the contract. And we did have interest from a couple of other companies, quite big, Stiff Records and ZTT, but then our record company turned around and said, all right, if you want to take them, you've got to give us £75,000 we've spent on them. So consequently, the interest called, so we were left in like no man's land for about 16 months, which, you know, that's a lot more common than what people think.
Well, I know, I hear about it all the time, and to me what you're doing is you're creating something out of nothing, and then it gets into the world of business and politics. And then it goes through the horse, and then it comes through the other end of the horse, and you have a whole different thing, you know. And that's not what you intended. That's not why you love music. Am I correct?
No.
I'm out on a limb here.
No. That is totally wrong. I had to get used to the fact when we signed that the songs that I'd written had become a product, and it was like sort of taken out of my hands a bit, like. The record company chose singles, what tracks they wanted. I mean, we had a say to a certain extent, but I think when you do first get signed, I mean, it is the holy grail for any musician to get a record company to invest in you. And in those days, when we were doing that, the early 2000s, they used to put quite a bit of money in and time. So we went from being basically bedroom musicians into a studio with, like, Eric Clapton's bass player and the Art of Noise as session people. So
awesome.
We went along with it, but I did realize that the songs have been taken out of my hand in effect. So yeah, you're right with that.
Crazy Town, yeah. And you're supposed to be creative, and you write happy, healthy music, and you're supposed to pull that out of thin air after that kind of crap. I don't know.
I know. Yeah. No, it's difficult.
You're very good at it.
Oh, thank you.
Do you find that you write to a point and then B gets it and then it becomes something even better?
Yeah. What? I mean, I write in the old-fashioned way. I mean, when I was a kid and a teenager, I was really interested in the songwriters and what they did, you know, and who had actually written the song. So I write in the old-fashioned way. I write with me, a guitar, and a blank piece of paper, and then I give myself about 45 minutes on each time, and if something hasn't come up, then I just give up because it's not going to come. I got that advice from Sting actually years ago, not personally, but I read something about him, and
Elton John says the same thing.
I think so. And then basically I do the lyrics, and then I've got the melody, and then I play it to B, and then we'll sit there and then we'll work out an arrangement for it, and she'll add bits that I hadn't thought of. And then what we generally do then is like leave the song for like a couple of weeks or play around with it. Just don't instantly record it, because it's amazing how many times I've listened back to a track and thought, God, I wish I'd done that on it, you know. But and that's what we do, and then we start building the track up.
The vocal arrangements get very elaborate sometimes. It's simple.
Yeah.
They're hooky. I want to explain the term hook. My listeners, you hear it a lot, but why don't you define it? It's kind of elusive, but it's something that's necessary, I think, in pop music. So go ahead.
My musical heroes of all time are the Beatles.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the absolute that's what everything I judge pop by them. They're the benchmark, as far as I'm concerned.
That's the gold standard.
They were they were so instant and in getting into their songs. I mean, even they tried a thing out that, you know, other people have used since, and that is they start off with the chorus and then go into the verse, like with She Loves You and Can't Buy Me Love. They were all preceded by actually starting with the chorus. So it is important to get, you know, that that mind worm into people's ears straight away. So I don't really hang about, you know, making them wait. I just try and get them, because I hate listening to an album where I have to keep on listening to it to get into it. I've always been a bit, you know, I'm a real pop fan, you know, like the classic pop. So
the saying that comes to mind is "Don't bore us, get to the chorus." I'm sure you've
heard
that.
Exactly.
Yeah, guy, you do it so well. And you'd think, well, you know, that format's been used over and over again. Well, there's a reason, I think. And you're right. The Beatles kind of did set the gold standard on that. Hard Day's Night starts out with a G7 suspended 4 on a 12-string guitar. And all of a sudden it's like, and then the hook. Boom. It's been a hard day's.
And that call's been the subject. If you go on YouTube now, you've got so many different people saying how that chord was played at A Hard Day's Night. It was apparently they had a bass note that was like a modulation on the main chord. I mean, it's very technical, but I mean, nobody's ever been able to work it out really what they did on that chord. But I mean, it's so, as soon as you hear that chord, you know what's coming.
Yeah, so it George Harrison and George Martin are gone, so maybe we'll never know the actual.
Sad, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, every time somebody passes like that, a little bit of my childhood goes with it.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
You're working with Pat Collier, the producer.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. He produced that Katrina and the Waves song, Walking on Sunshine.
Walking on Sunshine.
Yeah, that's it, yeah. And he's worked with other people like the House of Love, the Wonder Stuff, Belinda Carlisle. And to be quite honest, I was a fan of his before I ever got a record deal. And one of my friends one day said to me, when we were listening to Katrina and the Waves, an album of theirs, he said, you know, this he would be great for your stuff. I mean, then we didn't have a deal. But then I sent a demo of Blue Velvet to a DJ and a writer, Charlie Gillett, who was he supported Costello and Dire Straits at the beginning of their career. And I sent him Blue Velvet, and he phoned me one night at home, which I couldn't quite believe, because my mum came in and said, there's a Charlie Gillett on the phone for you. And I just rushed out there. And he said, I just have to say, he said that Blue Velvet is one of the best songs I've heard in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
He said, but you need to have a deal. He said, but, you know, I wish you luck with it, because he couldn't really offer it. He said, but I'm going to put you in touch with Pat Collier, who was one of my heroes. And I didn't preempt him at all. And he said, because I think, you know, that would be a marriage made in heaven, you two working together. And then I spoke to Pat, and he said, well, you know, in those days you needed a deal, really, because, I mean, studio costs were about, you know, £500 to £600 a day.
Yeah.
Then. So he said, but if you ever get signed, I would be interested. And then a couple of years later, when we did get signed, I asked to work with him, and the record company said he's too expensive. And then we got put with a producer that we didn't get on with, really. We got on, he's a lovely bloke, but it was just too long-winded what we're doing. So we asked Pat again, and then Pat said, look, I want to do it, so I'll lower my fee and take some points on the album. And that's how we got to work with him. So, yeah, it was brilliant.
Boy, I guess. Well, what were the lyrics? Where did that come from?
What's a Blue Velvet?
Yes.
I got the inspiration from that from a song by a band, not very well known, called The Bible. And they had a tracker called Honey Be Good. I don't know really. I mean, it's influenced by Costello as well. I suppose it's like a lost love in a relationship, really, which I think appeals most probably to everyone. But I must say, that was the song. That was the last song I wrote before me and Trudy started going out together, because she said she saw something else in me when she heard that song. So it was.
Thank you. She wore blue velvet. She wore blue velvet. She wore blue
You write better when you're smitten and you're falling in love and you've got that rush going on? Or
I actually think no. I think I think it's when you get the wrong end of the, you know, like the,
oh really,
the shitty end of the stick, really. Yeah, because it's a bit. I love that with like Elvis Costello, like his bitter lyrics and everything. I mean, it was, you know, I mean, it's bordering on misogyny in a way, but I really got, yeah, I find it hard to write happy, so I had to do that for the Eurovision Song Contest a few years ago, and one of those tracks is going to be on our next album that's coming out in the fall, and that was difficult because I had to write two uplifting, like, joyous songs, so I really had to change my mindset for writing them.
Why is it, to me, they come across as being happy songs?
Yeah, I know.
The lyrics aren't necessarily, but it almost makes it somewhat of a paradox in that, we're sad talking, but we happy. We sound happy.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, because it's very upbeat, isn't it? And I think that's like down to Pat's production as well. It's so, like, you know, high energy that he put into it, and he was always demanding that of us when we were in the studio. But yeah, I know what you mean. It is a bit of a paradox that some of the lyrics, if you look at them more closely, are all about relationships that have gone wrong.
Yeah, and Elvis Costello really is good at that. I heard an interview with Paul McCartney, and they were doing some stuff together. This was probably 20, 30 years ago. And he said writing with Elvis Costello was like writing with John Lennon, because Paul would say, I got to admit it's getting better, and Lennon would say it can't get no worse. So they kind of bounce back and forth with that kind of a thing.
Yeah, I love that with Lennon. I mean, some of the songs he wrote were so bitter, like Run For Your Life, which I think now would say was a bit misogynistic, you know, with some of the comments in that, I'd rather see you dead than see you with another man. It's heavy. You know, that for 1966, that is pushing it a bit, I think.
It really was. I'm sure, and you've probably run into this, somebody told him not to do it, but he went ahead and did it. And because he was a Beatle and they were the hottest thing on the planet at the time, he could do it.
Yeah.
But I'm sure you write stuff that somebody says, no, we got to change that around. And how do you deal with that?
Well, I had that problem actually in Pretty Blue Gun, because I was doing rhythm guitar, but, you know, I do both guitars now because it's just the two of us. But we had a lead guitarist who objected to some of my misogynist lyrics. So he called me round for a meeting with the drummer. The drummer said he wanted a meeting. I went round and I listened to his argument. And then he said, you know, how do you feel about that? And I said, well, if you don't like it, you can always leave the group. So that ended it, really.
Oh, jeez. Well, that's a short conversation, huh?
Yeah, well, I think you've got to write what you believe and be honest with yourself. And when somebody starts, like, you know, editing what you're doing, I was just not having it, really. But I do know, like, with something, you have got to pull back a little bit. I mean, I've thought of lines before, and I thought, oh, no, I can't use that. So, yeah. But I just like with Lennon and Costello, they're witty, his lyrics. They're cutting, but they're very, like, a very dry way of getting the message over.
I totally understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
You've written for TV and film, right?
Yeah. We're working on one now, actually, for a film company. That's got to be done by the weekend, so we're getting onto that tomorrow. Yeah, well, what it was, they've actually used some of those tracks from Big Blue World on the TV in this country. In a couple of soap operas, you know, like where you get a scene, say someone's in a bar and there's a jukebox playing. Well, a lot of TV and film companies, rather than paying an exorbitant fee for getting to say, like, use a Beatles song or somebody really well known, they go for an artist like us who's not so well known, nowhere near as well known, but writes in the similar style that they want. So we get briefed saying we want this, you know, we need a song in the style of so and so. So then we try and do that. But more often than not, we've just written the song, and then somebody from a TV company would say, yeah, that would be a fit, and then the publishers use it. They get together with the publishers and use it.
That's cool. Any exposure is good exposure, I suppose.
Oh, yeah.
You write
and perform. Apparently, one of our songs was used on an advert in South Africa. I don't know why.
Of all places? Well, that's cool. With the advent of the internet, I guess you can be in Antarctica and the penguins are going to be dancing. I don't know.
That's right. I mean, I've got an interview later this year with a radio station in Trinidad and Tobago. So, and that's all the wonder of the interview. I mean, it's a great thing in a way for musicians because, you know, when we started, you had to have a deal to get onto the radio. That no way could you get your stuff heard. But now, I mean, it's opened it up to everybody, which is great in some ways. But then again, you've got to really push yourself and get the right people behind you to, like, stand out from the rest.
Same thing with this podcast. You know, I have analytics that show what countries it's being listened to, and it's all over the world. And I don't know how to speak Chinese, but somebody in China's listening to it, so it's got to be
amazing, isn't it?
Somebody that speaks English, unless they just listen to hear the music that I put in there. But what's the biggest challenge as an indie musician, though? Has technology been your friend, or it's such a gigantic sea of opportunity?
Well, as I say, B has been brilliant. She's actually learned how to engineer. We've got a home studio now, and she's taken the time and she's had lessons to do it. And I think I sent you a track last week, didn't I? A new one. Yeah, she engineered that, and Pat Collier mixed it, and I played the guitars and the bass on it. But she's really got her head around that. It's terrible in a way, but I've never been able to get an interest in it. It's a bit shameful, really. But yeah, she's on behalf of both of us, she's managed to learn all that stuff. And it is, when I first started, it was just like a 4-track recorder on tape.
Yeah.
And now, my God, you know, you're using Cubase and you're using all this that support it, and Steinberg. Oh, but I give her credit. She's really stuck at it.
She's a keeper. I think you should.
And she does all the drum programming as well.
Oh, wow.
You know, yeah.
The song you sent me is called Can't Hope to Hold Out, correct?
Yeah.
Again, awesome.
Don't run from me.
You've been listening to the Better Each Day Podcast Radio Show with Bruce Hilliard. We'll be back with a new horizon, but until then, honor the future. It comes with a lifetime guarantee.
And we're all just trying to make the next day a bit better.